Malcolm, this is an interesting situation. Malcolm Honlein, who's with us every Friday for the weekly update, he told us he'd be back in the U.S. this morning, and officially he is in the U.S., but the plane was so late that he's actually traveling by car from the airport, and that's how we're going to connect with him this morning. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations and joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM and the AM.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Was it a great journey, and did you make that stop in Greece, as you originally had told us you would?
Yes, I didn't go to Cyprus. Some of my colleagues did, but I stayed for the funeral for Eric Sharon, and then I went to Greece where I met the president, prime minister, foreign minister, and other leaders in a really two-day whirlwind trip that was very productive and reflects some of the changes in the Mediterranean basin that could have really long-term consequences for the good.
Well, you of course, are referring to the world political angle of it. So much of the news from Greece over the last, I don't know, year or two in this area has been about the economic situation. Were you able to get a handle speaking with leaders in that region about what's going on with that situation at this point?
Look, it remains very serious. The unemployment rate still very high. It's over 25%, especially amongst young people. It's even higher. There is a turnabout. Things are getting somewhat better, but it'll be a long-term project to really revitalize it. And they have the problems of the influx of foreigners. And, of course, the big issue that has gotten a lot of attention is the Golden Dawn Party, which is a neo-Nazi extremist party. But they arrested some of the leaders this week and have outlawed the party, essentially. They sit the parliament, but they've been very isolated, and the government has taken bold and concrete actions, which I hope will be replicated in other countries where these kind of extremist parties like Jobbik are rising in Hungary and all over Europe, in fact.
And before we talk about the funeral, why did part of the group go to Cyprus? What was there?
Well, the truth is that this we're talking about an Israel-Cyprus-Greece alliance, or informal alliance, I should say, connection, where everything from common tourism, energy exploration, security issues, Israel and Greece have been doing a lot of joint exercises and training. The Greeks have been very open to Israel's needs for strategic depth, etc. So this is a budding relationship, and Cyprus is a key element in it as well. So they went to Cyprus to meet the president and prime minister and other officials.
What were your impressions of the Sharon funeral? And I mean, not to look back at his entire life right now, but in terms of the ceremony and event itself, I mean, you were there as an insider and saw how many people from around the world attended. What were your impressions of the funeral?
Well, I think it was very dignified. It was extremely well organized. I mean, split second, and people, leaders who were there, who told me that they contrasted it to the Mandela funeral, which seems to have been very chaotic and not organized well. They told me here that, I mean, everybody was handled. There weren't that many world leaders, of course. It wasn't comparable to the Mandela turnout or others. But, you know, Vice President Biden was there, Tony Blair, many others who came and... and I have to say also that it I think would have been something he would have appreciated. That obviously the military component was very strong in terms of the speeches, people he was closest with, who generals and others who spoke about him, and at the farm his kids, his sons spoke. They did not at the Knesset ceremony, which is guided by established protocol, I think, as to who gets to speak and not.
Interesting. And one of the things that was noted about Zev Hever was there and spoke, an old friend of Sharon from Gush Emunim, somebody who was very critical of him during the time of the disengagement. Was that a surprise that he appeared there?
It was. To me, it was a surprise. But, you know, Sharon's life went through many phases, and whatever differences people had, there was always a sense of loyalty, especially amongst his camaraderie of the generals and the military people. But... you saw the spectrum of people who turned out. I was fortunate to be in the front row, so I could see everybody on the opposite side. You know, they were facing each other and see all of the spectrum of political and religious leaders who came. And there were not many from the United States, Elliot Engel and Debbie Schultz, Wasserman Schultz was there with the vice president, and the organizational representation was very limited. But the you know, amongst Israelis, and especially during the time he laid in state, and you saw the thousands of people who came by, really represented the spectrum of the Israeli population.
Might one of his sons go into Israeli politics? Some people I spoke to said they had the feeling that at least one would.
Yeah, that's been speculated a lot, but I don't know. I didn't see any sign of it.
Also, WikiLeaks reported that Sharon, as prime minister, planned more withdrawals after the Gaza disengagement. Is there any reason not to believe that?
There are these reports. I asked people. Nobody seemed to have any kind of confirmation about it, but that report was circulated, but it died very quickly, so I don't know whether anybody found any substance to it.
And rockets were fired from Gaza after Sharon's funeral. Timing coincidence or not?
No, not at all. But there have been a series of attacks in the days before, and one of the reasons why there was hesitancy to have the funeral at the farm was the fear that they would fire, and they did, and they landed some kilometers away. That never posed an immediate threat, and the Iron Dome was deployed and knocked down 5 missiles in one day. But there is an escalation clearly from Gaza, and the IAF responded appropriately. And yesterday it seemed to have been quiet.
And to sum it up in terms of his life, now that the funeral has taken place, essentially it's just, I guess, one big conflict. Depending on who you are, you remember Ariel Sharon in many, many different ways, right?
That's true. And look, you can't deny his contribution, his bravery, his courage, what he did in the 73 war and other times. And he went through clearly some major changes. I don't know that we'll ever understand exactly why. I heard various people commenting and speculating or claiming they had discussions. I talked to him many times. I had a very good relationship with him. And I honestly do not know what motivated him on a lot of the decisions and things that we had to talk about. But I think no one can deny his consistent concern for the state, as a Jewish state, and also for the Jewish people. He cared very much about what people in the diaspora believed and were concerned about, and said that first and foremost he is a Jew. He said that every time he came to the States and in speeches in Israel as well.
Fascinating figure. Really unbelievable. And when you think about the ups and downs, the peaks and valleys in his career, I don't know if anybody ever had such extremes, just unbelievable, including the last 8 years, of course. All right, this is the story of the day. I'll start with this only because you were just there, so I'm curious. Did you know about the Netanyahu-Abdullah meeting before it took place?
I was in Greece when it took place, but I did meet with the prime minister before I left, and I did not know exactly when, but I did know that they talked about having a meeting this week.
So how unusual is this? Obviously, it's a headline, and everyone, calls
it. He met with him 3 or 4 times over the last year. It's not that unusual for the two of them to get together. This is a, especially critical time with the peace process and other things going on for them to discuss. But it's not that unusual. They do talk quite regularly.
So what do we call this? Is it a negotiation? Is there a dispute? Is this just a get-together to make sure everyone's on the same page?
I wouldn't say it's a dispute because I think they agree on most things. I think it's a consultation is the best way to put it.
And consulting on what? What types of issues?
On the peace process, or concerns about the Jordan Valley, and that is, Jordan's concerns are as great as Israel, maybe even greater, to talk about the developments in the region vis-a-vis Hamas what's happening in Syria, the movement of the refugees, and concern regarding Iran.
Maybe in some ways a rhetorical question because it seems that it applies to every country in the Middle East at this point. But would you say that Jordan's concern for Syria and for Iran is as strong as Israel's?
For Syria, absolutely, because they have 1 million refugees there, and the number grows, and of course there's a big border. And Syria always had designs on Jordan as part of what they considered Greater Syria at one time. But the concern regarding Iran is very great, especially given developments in Iraq with the feeling of Iran taking over, or certainly through Maliki, the head of the government, and the Sunni-Shiite divide, which would affect them as well. So the instability in the region impacts Jordan disproportionately because of its own balances within its population and the nature of the government there.
Yeah, I spoke to some high school Israel advocacy students this week, and I'm dedicating this question to them. Malcolm, why is it that, as compared to other countries, Israel has what seems to be a much stronger relationship and simply get along better with Jordan?
Because they have common interests. They have a common border that's very important. Their concerns regarding what happens within the Palestinian Authority areas is as great as Israel's, because it spills over to them, where they have a two-thirds Palestinian population already, where you have Muslim Brotherhood active, you have this influx of refugees. All of these issues really bond Israel and Jordan together, and they cooperate. The military security cooperation has always been outstanding, even though the king, as is understandable, has at times be critical. But the level of cooperation has been sustained.
Malcolm Honlein, Weekly Update. This dust-up between the Defense Minister of Israel and the Secretary of State in the U.S., could you first tell us what really happened in terms of Yalon's statement, and then I'll ask you about whether his apology was necessary.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I actually saw Boogie the day before. I had a meeting with him, and look, there's deep concern all over about the substance negotiations, the 11, 12 visits already by Secretary Kerry, any other things that have impacted. And he gave a private interview, an off-the-record private interview with Shimon Schiffer, who then proceeded to publish some of the content. So it violates, basic media rule and principle, but the... of course, when somebody says something like that, it's going to get a lot of coverage.
He basically said that, the way I understood it, give the man his Nobel Peace Prize, so he'll leave us alone, right? Basically, that's the way it went?
Well, that was the last thing he said. But he said he talked about it being obsessive,
right.
Obsessive interest, that he's a messianic view, and what the feeling is that they... But I don't know that those terms are right. I do think that he has an inordinate focus on this, because he feels that it's a place of the movement. It is an air of responsibility that was given to him. If you look at the rest of the region, what's happening in Iraq, Afghanistan, the Syrian negotiations, Iran, there isn't much there that you can point to with great pride and say we've had a great accomplishment.
Yes,
even the deal with Iran, which I think we'll talk about, but which has a lot of flaws and a lot of problems. So this is the area, and it is the thing for which people get Nobel Prizes. And the president gave him this arena to play in and to see what he could do. So he is very determined to do it.
So with all that in... I'm sorry?
I was just going to say, but there are a lot of things that, don't come necessarily visible to the public. There's supposed to be side understandings or the assurance that he gave the Palestinians about 67 borders, many other things that complicated. But he has had regular communication with the prime minister on sometimes 2-3 times a week or more. And he has visited there, as I said, I think a dozen times.
So with all that in mind, was the Yalon apology necessary?
If you notice, he did not apologize. He said that that he didn't intend to insult, and if he took his words as if it was hurtful or harmful, he apologized for that. He did not retract what he said.
Yeah, correct. But certainly those who are not aligned with him in the Knesset took it as an apology. They were upset that he apologized.
Certainly, he had to say something to defuse the situation.
Right. And did Bibi have a reaction to this?
Bibi made statements reaffirming the relationship with Kerry and trying to contain the damage.
I read an article, I forgot who wrote it. It was on the Jerusalem Post website, that basically everybody's got to chill out, because if we think that one insult like this is going to make the U.S.-Israel relationship collapse, then you have another thing coming. And I thought there was a little bit of truth to that, this is not the disaster that some people in the media are painting it to be.
We also have to look at the fact that many times language is used that is unfortunate, whether intentional or not. As the United States, some of the statements that came out of the National Security Council against senators who didn't support, who supported the legislation on Iran and didn't support the administration position, and the hint that they want to drive to war, they were warmongers, these kind of this terminology, this is unacceptable.
Right.
And you didn't see apologies for it. coming forward, but they certainly toned down the rhetoric.
Malcolm,
it happens. Should it happen? That's a good question. Was it wise? You know, and becomes a distraction. Also, a good question that I guess we'll know in time.
Understood. Malcolm Hoenlein, it's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning Radio program. Heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial. Around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Again, you were just in Jerusalem, so it gives me more of an impetus to bring this up today. Will the new police station in the Har HaZeitim Cemetery on the Mount of Olives, will it in fact help deter all the rock throwing that has become commonplace up there?
I certainly hope that it will. The station is there. The problem is there's nobody in it. And I had a series of discussions about this, and I hope that it'll be that we're moving towards rectification. The government is allotting a lot of money.
Oh, so when they say March 1st, that means that they're actually going to pay attention and man the station on March 1st? That's when it's going to begin?
Yes, the station is there, the police station, and there were people in it periodically, but not on a sustained basis. And that's the problem.
And that's what's going to change. In other words, they're going to make an effort.
Well, also, more cameras are going to be up there. More people will be assigned to it, including Shin Bet, which is very important. They also talking about closing the entrance, one entrance to the school, which is where most of the problems emerged from. And that would make a difference. Also, we found out that the school closes at 3. And the buses pick them up at 5 or 1 and 3. And that during all that time, they were able to do a lot of mischief.
A lot of downtime. You know what that leads to. The Prime Minister of Canada is arriving in Israel after this weekend, correct?
Well, I just wanted to say that there is a serious approach and that the Security Cabinet did address this last week, which is a big progress and largely due to the committee here and the Lipinskis and others who have been really devoted to it.
All right, so there's movement in that area. The Prime Minister of Canada is set to arrive in Jerusalem beginning of next week, correct?
Absolutely. With a delegation, I think, of 200 Canadian leaders, Jewish leaders, business leaders, others. It's a huge thing, and as you know, he's been outspokenly pro-Israel, so they're looking forward to him with great anticipation.
And have we discovered why yet? Not that anyone needs a reason to to be allied with Israel, but is it something about his background, relationships, associations that has given him this amazing desire to publicly laud the Jewish state constantly?
I think, first of all, it is personal. I think it is also, some people have said to me, you know, his religious views and other views, that his view of the world. But it wasn't isolated. You know, during the Sharon funeral, one of the visitors was an official from, I think, the Prime Minister of Australia. And she made a remarkable statement that it's calling the settlements illegal under international law is wrong. She said, I defy you to show me one international law that they violate.
Wow.
So we have friends around the world. And Greece, I said, it's a remarkable turnabout. Other countries, and even some in the Middle East, are looking to Israel very differently than they have in the past.
We keep reading about, I mean, you mentioned the Nazi parties in Europe, and we keep reading about the European Union and concerted efforts to condemn Israel or boycott Israel. It's good to hear that there's some countries on this globe that are taking a different approach.
Yes, but I want to minimize the impact of the boycott movement. We spent the whole day yesterday in consultations. We had people from Europe and all over the world came to Jerusalem, and we spent literally the whole day talking about it. And in America, it's serious, and it became more clear because of the American Studies Association issue.
Yeah, but isn't the epicenter of the boycott a trend Europe? Isn't that the...
Yes.
It is.
Yes, but I'm saying that when you listen to them and how much they encounter on a daily basis this problem. I mean, we count it periodically, increasingly. We saw it at the Modern Languages Association. And why, I know many of your listeners and others were always curious or questioning about why I put so much emphasis on this issue of the delegitimization. And I keep telling you that it is one of the challenges of our time. It is, next to Iran, the most serious issue we face.
Right. No question about that. Have you landed yet? It sounds like you're still riding the plane over there.
No, I'm here on the ground.
When we said we were speaking to Malcolm during the tail end of his trip, we meant it, folks. Prime Minister Netanyahu has declared that he would meet with the president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, but insists that Tehran must be willing to recognize Israel. Actually, to be more accurate, he said he would consider a meeting if Iran went ahead and recognized Israel. I don't think we're going to have this problem to face in the very near future, right?
I think that Rouhani's comments would indicate that he shouldn't pack his bags at this point.
Right.
That if you look at some of the things that he said, this is a guy with whom we've signed this, or well, we didn't actually sign an agreement. It's one of the important points is that it's an understanding, a working plan, and we don't know what side agreements are. There are all sorts of reports about additional components that we may not know about. We've seen this week the Russians announcing this $1.5 billion a month oil deal, the Iranians a $50 billion deal. All the time we're being told that the sanctions regime is sustained. It is, but this is clearly major breakthroughs, and they are, and Rouhani speaks about it all the time, emphasizing what the benefits they got. And he actually used the term that America surrendered in this deal. And the fact is that they are allowed to continue research on the centrifuges, the more and more advanced centrifuges, which is very troubling. And in one of the discussions with the U.S. official, they said, so what if they have the gold? But what can they do? It's just value for value. And it's not. Gold is what enables them to bypass the sanctions that are imposed on the banks. And we know that these new generation centrifuges are being allowed to be used to be tested for research. But all of that means is that when the deal actually collapses or formally collapses, that they'll be able to rush ahead with a much faster process of enrichment.
Right.
The other thing is the IEA has been given inspection. I mean, these are the points that are being raised as the good things. But in fact, they're not. They say themselves that they don't have enough access to really do a thorough job on monitoring what is happening there.
In fact, I read somewhere this week that one of the nuclear officials in Iran had said that within a day we're back up and running. Like, don't worry about this agreement or not this agreement. It's not going to stifle us in the least.
And they have an extra ton of stuff that they have been able to enrich. So I'm still told that the basis will be the November amounts, the 7,000 tons that they had enriched. I don't know if it makes a difference if you have 7,000 tons or 8,000 tons. The fact is that they can enrich quickly. The new centrifuges will enable them to do it even more quickly. And they're being very blatant in their internal statements. They still talk about defeating the United States, about extending their influence, and while we would like to see a resolution, it doesn't seem that what we're being presented with, we see that increased activities backing Hezbollah, backing Assad, increased activities in Iraq, and many other things which are furthering the instability of the region, not the stability.
What does it mean that on the 29th of January, UN inspectors will visit nuclear mines in Iran for the first time in 9 years? What is that? What is a nuclear mine, and what is this all about?
Okay, these are the uranium mines where they will be able for the first time to inspect the facilities. This is part of the deal to look at all the phases of enrichment, which means mining uranium, processing uranium, taking it then to the enrichment facilities, enriching it, weaponizing it, and putting it on a missile to deliver.
A lot of steps,
so,
huh?
Under the agreement, R&D, research and development, is not impacted. The missiles are not. The weaponization is not. But they do have periodic visits. But these are arranged visits or supervised visits, I think they're called, which means that they will have to make an appointment. They can't just drop in and say, hello, I'm here for tea, and I want to see what you're digging out of the ground here and what you're processing.
But
Israel's position and many others feel that there should be no enrichment, no processing on Iranian soil.
But what gets me is if this step is important in this, in the entire process. I mean, I always thought there was, I don't know, some type of shuttle of UN inspectors into Iran, even during times when there wasn't a formal agreement. Wasn't there always some type of UN inspection of this process over the last few years? Or am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. It's actually a very good question because it's very unclear for most people. There were periodic inspections of designated facilities. These were had to be arranged. They knew in advance when they were coming. But most of the facilities, like Parchin, which we have talked about, and I know this gets technical for people, but it's really important. The military facilities have never been breached, and they're not being inspected now under this deal. Parchin is where we believe that they did the experimentation on weaponization, and that facility has not been visited. So what this does is it does broaden the inspection. It takes them into the Iraq plutonium facility. Now, again, I hear that there was a stepped-up activities to finish as much as possible for the deadline of January 20th, 29th, when all this activities is supposed to stop and the agreement implemented. The enrichment to the 20% enriched stuff is supposed to be out of there in 3 months, not 6 months. That was a change, but we'll wait and see how fast they do it. And a lot of this stuff can be undone, just as the sanctions release can be reversed, they say. I think it'll be very hard because so many people have entrenched interests and so many things will have happened that it's not just something you can shut off and shut on. What is clear is that Tehran has continued to grow its nuclear program. They are producing new generations of in Natanz and Fordo of centrifuges for their facilities. They have 19,000 centrifuges in place. They're continuing their expansion in the region. And look how Zarif visited Lebanon, visited Jordan, visited other countries, the foreign minister of Iran, that is. So they're doing anything but backing off now.
All right, so as I understand it now, and I think I'm starting to get it a drop, so the 29th is essentially the deadline for the agreement in that at that point, UN inspectors will have the right or will exercise their right to start from the very beginning of the process and inspect every step of the process.
That they are allowed to. They're saying that they still do not have enough access, that
right.
They have limited access, but they don't have enough to really do the job right, which means that we have to make sure that the IEA should be given greater access, greater number of inspectors that can go in and on a regular basis monitor exactly what is happening there. But the deal now goes into effect. What the IEA people have said that the increased access to Iran to monitor the agreement, but it says it needs to investigate suspicions that they may have worked on designing a bomb and to look at other facilities, and all of this needs much more sophisticated investigation. And the reports that they have a GPS-guided ballistic missile under development, these are all things that they would like to learn about.
Is there any level of investigation that you'd be satisfied with? Meaning, is there, you know, just we talk about sanctions and alternatives to military strikes, is there any level of inspection, better word than investigation, is there any level of inspection that you would be satisfied with?
I would say if they send in all the OU mashkichim and we can have full access to inspect everything, that may be, but the truth is that they have the ability to create clandestine facilities. I don't know that we'll ever know the full truth. It's a big country. It's 70 million people, big area. They have a record of doing things in secret. So could there be, would I be surprised if tomorrow it came out that they had additional facilities where they're testing, where they're doing research and development, where they may have additional centrifuges? I would not. I think these are the main facilities, and you know, putting them on hold right now is a good thing. The problem is that this deal is full of so many loopholes, and there's so many things that mitigate against seeing them having gone through some sort of metamorphosis and long-term change. He says that, as I told you, when he puts things in the term that the surrender of the Great Satan, meaning the United States, and that the Geneva Agreement itself is has broken the wall of sanctions, and he boasts about, you know, the achievement. And this is the same guy who did this when he was negotiator in 2003 and wrote a book about how he lied and obfuscated it. I mean, and we see the same pattern emerging here.
It sounds like there's no level of inspection that you'd be satisfied with. It sounds like to me, and by the way, the other option, which we haven't discussed in a while, it's also possible, you mentioned that they could have clandestine activities going on, and you wouldn't be surprised if you found out that, if anyone found out that they had other areas where they were building these types of facilities, there could be allies as well. They could be distracting the entire world while a neighbor of theirs is going ahead and helping them develop these weapons. Is that far-fetched? Is that a little too crazy?
Not at all. Remember, the reactor in Syria that Israel eliminated was an Iranian-North Korean project.
Right, so there you have it.
We know that they're doing a lot of things with North Korea.
So we are constantly looking at Iran and with their alliances in both South America and other areas of the Middle East and other areas of the world. Who knows what they're controlling at this point?
And remember, Iran today, when we were in Greece, they showed me graphs which showed the missile range from Iran covering Greece. So as much as we do those things in regard to Israel and the Middle East,
they're worried.
Other countries, European countries, are looking at this, and they're worried, and they know what a danger it poses, because Iran is operating throughout the Balkans, the Baltics, everywhere. They're trying to expand their influence. And they have today over 400 ballistic missiles, and some of them can carry a 750-kilogram warhead. Syria has 200 to 300. They've used some of them in the war. Some are probably disabled. They have tens of thousands of rockets between Syria and Hezbollah, and tens of thousands more of the light rockets, which are being turned into smart rockets, according to reports, where they put on sensors and homing sensors and GPS. Well, because part of the problem was that all these rockets would be fired, but they didn't have missile guidance systems, so they could hit anywhere. Today, even these smaller rockets are now being equipped with more up-to-date homing devices and sensors, as well as GPS guidance systems.
Wow.
So there's a whole new level of danger, but this range of strike capability includes Europe as well. Greece being one part of it, but it can strike up to the heart of Europe.
It's amazing. We concentrate so much on Israel, we don't consider what other countries are going through in terms of their own security vis-a-vis Iran. There was a story this week, which, I don't know, it seemed to be somewhat of a big deal, about Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State mulling over the possibility of giving Israel a green light for a strike on Iran. I would imagine anybody in her position, including the Secretary of State today, is always mulling over that question. Is this a news story?
Well, I don't think it's a news story. I had the opportunity to discuss with her before she became a Secretary of State, and I know she had very strong views on Iran at the time. But during the tenure of the first Obama administration, we did not see that kind of strength. Was there and is there always going to be that option of, taking hands off and letting Israel do what it has to do? We'll have to wait till the next volume of her memoirs comes out and she has a chance to really put it in perspective. But other officials, I know for sure, have always talked about it. What you said was important before about, we focus on Israel.
Right.
But the reason we do is because Israel is the only country that's standing up now to Iran.
Right.
If you look at all the rest, they're collapsing in front of them. They're sending trade delegations, they want to get in on the money, and they don't think about the potential that this could be, a major change in the whole region, that Iran allowed to rejoin the international community without having given up anything will pose such great dangers in the future to all of them.
But there's got to be other countries you could put in that category. I mean, even Jordan. I mean, we just discussed at the beginning of this conversation.
And Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, they're much more worried even than Israel. They say Israel can defend itself. We can't. Many countries, Bahrain, all of the Gulf area,
and
many others.
They're not taking as active a role because they simply don't believe they have the capability. Israel, they look to as one that has the capability.
That's what they say, that Israel's our only hope to do it. They said, we'll condemn them, but it's our only hope.
We'll condemn them, but they're our only hope. Doesn't that sum it up? Are you for or against this ban of the word Nazi in Israel?
I don't know that you can really ban individual words. It's the usage. I mean, what somebody taught you, it depends the context in which it's used. I do think, though, that extremism and the danger of using language and minimizing it, and it's not just the use of the word Nazi, this news quinelle, whatever it's called, the Nazi salute,
right,
is spreading to all the sports in Europe. Now, this is a way of expressing anti-Semitism. You can't say Heil Hitler because it's against the law in many countries, but you do this quinelle, which was devised by the comedian Dugan, who's blatantly anti-Semitic and anti-Israel. The message was clear to people who knew what it was. It was more subtle. Now it's less so as people recognize it. And when sports figures use it, some instantly apologized. They didn't know what it meant. They just did it. Now people know what it means. And when you see it, you got to know it. And incitement is becoming a big issue in the Middle East. The Prime Minister has talked consistently with U.S. officials and others about the PA. And what makes it unique in the PA is that it's government-sponsored. It's coming through official media, broadcasts, television programs, textbooks, many other things. And I know again, it's the kind of thing that people tend to dismiss, and they say, well, you know, we're all used to it. No, this is a major obstacle to peace, and it's got to be portrayed, and there has to be a constant effort to expose. And I think, in general, when it comes to the delegitimization and the efforts to demonize, and too often we dismiss the words, and people say, why do you fight over this expression or that expression? I think now the time has come that we have to raise the profile, that we have to go after every one of them, like we did with the American Studies Association. We have to nip it in the bud right away before it spreads, because it's becoming too commonplace. We have to be more aggressive and in intelligent ways. It doesn't mean, you know, we declare nuclear war every time something happens. You have to do it in a proportionate way. But it has to be very clear that this is unacceptable, and we're not going to back off. Look, there are other positive developments, too. You know, the Egyptian vote, the stability of Egypt, which would be a great asset if the military were able to establish it. And now they're talking about going after Hamas now that they have hopefully neutralized the Muslim Brotherhood and certainly are taking a more aggressive stance in the Sinai. So there are positive developments. But if you look at what the nature of, to go back to your original question, about the changing nature of the discourse,
right,
and where Nazi salutes and Nazi references have the hate behind it, the danger, the true story, is now being lost.
Yeah, but I was asking from the point of view of this proposed Israeli bill that they don't want the word used in Israel to, you know, one against the other. That's what they are.
Right. Well, it shouldn't be used. It should be, we mitigate the true story of the Shoah by doing it.
Right.
But again, you know, the laws are different. America doesn't have libel laws, for instance. We can't outlaw Holocaust denial. We can take action against it. But in Europe, it's against the law. In Israel, Right. It's against the law.
Somewhat
different.
Before we wrap up, I'm always curious about this, and I forgot to ask you at the beginning of the conversation. Is there an Orthodox or what you would call a traditional community in Greece?
There's Chabad, and the community, especially in Saloniki, which was a great Jewish community.
Right.
You know, the ports used to close down on Shabbos and Yom Tov because all the stevedores were Jewish, and
Right. Jews
controlled the ports. It was a magnificent community. There are now a little over 5,000, maybe up to 6,000 Jews in all of Greece. But they have functioning synagogues and kosher food. And in Saloniki, there are also facilities. The government, by the way, invests a lot in emphasizing the Jewish history, the Jewish past, the Jewish connection. It's really widely discussed.
Interesting. All right, welcome back to the U.S.
My pleasure. Thank you. It's good to be back, I guess. But Jerusalem was so beautiful. The weather has been beautiful, and business seems to be doing pretty well. A lot of visitors there. Tourism record month in December. So a lot to be appreciative of.
No question about that. Malcolm Honlein, I thank you. Have a wonderful Shabbos. We'll reconvene next week. Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us Fridays for the weekly update here at JM and the AM.